Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, why protests against stay-at-home measures have popped up around the country and who's behind them. Though the numbers are relatively small in North Carolina, Texas, Michigan, and Utah, men and women have gathered at state houses to oppose their governor's responses to coronavirus and the social distancing laws being used to combat the public health crisis. Their message has gotten support from some powerful people, including the president himself. So who are these protesters and who's funding their efforts? I asked Jane Costin, senior political reporter at Vox. Jane, it's good of you to join us. Thank you. There have been these anti-stay-at-home protests around the country. Tell us, first of all, where they've been and how large they've been.
So the anti-stay-at-home protests have taken place in a number of states, and they've varied in size. In Michigan, there were a couple thousand attendees, but in Maryland, for example, the Maryland governor's office joked that they'd gotten more media requests than attendees to the protests. But protests have also taken place in Huntington Beach, California, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and a small protest in Columbus, Ohio as well.
So they vary in size and the governors are targeted, I gather.
Yes. It's been interesting because many of these protests have been aimed at Democratic governors, but there have been protests taking place in states with strict stay-at-home orders, but Republican governors as well, for example, in Ohio.
Jane, how spontaneous are they?
Well, it's hard to say. One of the challenges is that two things can be true at once. Some of these protests have been organized by people on the ground, who are concerned by what they view as draconian measures coming from state governors. At the same time, many of these efforts are also being organized by conservative groups with close ties to the White House, for example, Stephen Moore's group. He was going to be a part of the Federal Reserve Board before some misogynistic comments that he made arose as a result of people doing some reporting. So groups like FreedomWorks and others have assisted some of these protests taking place and helped to advertise them and spread them. And even some of the protest organizers have reported that when they reached out for assistance, you know, groups associated with Trump's reelection campaign, for example, came basically and took over the protest, which made it more successful from their viewpoint, but also changed the message to be much more partisan.
Well, help me understand just how they are organized.
So these protests are organized in different ways. For example, the protests in Michigan were organized by members of two specific groups, the Michigan Conservative Coalition and another group with close ties to the Trump reelection campaign. For example, one of the organizers has close ties with Women for Trump in the state of Michigan. Some of the groups in Idaho and Wisconsin also have close ties with groups like FreedomWorks, which listeners may recall from the 2009-2010 Tea Party movement, as one of the groups that helped to foment that protest movement. So it varies. Some of these protests have been very small, where they've gotten far more likes on Facebook than actual attendees in person. And so how each of these protests is organized is very case specific, but these protests have gotten a fair amount of attention and notice and response from conservative organizations that are supportive of the president's reelection campaign.
And is someone footing the bill for them?
It's unclear at this point. I think there'll be a lot of interesting reporting to be done in the next 6 months, specifically after financial disclosures are released. But some members of these protest groups have reported that FreedomWorks, for example, sent over signage and assistance in that way. And so it'll be interesting to see what we learn over the next couple of weeks and months about some of the finances behind these protest groups.
So you mentioned Stephen Moore. Isn't Reince Priebus also involved?
Yes, there are a host of longtime Republican, I would say, politicos who are involved in these movements. In Michigan, for example, Greg McNeely is involved. He leads a group called the Michigan Freedom Fund. He also served as campaign manager for Republican Dick DeVos's 2006 gubernatorial campaign. Dick DeVos is married to Betsy DeVos, who currently serves as U.S. Secretary of Education. So there are a host of these groups with ties to Reince Priebus, Stephen Moore, Art Laffer, a host of other people with close ties to this administration and to Republican Party politics more broadly.
So how do you separate protests about enforced staying at home from an effort to reelect President Trump?
Well, I think that that's a really big challenge as reporters. And I think that one of my concerns and something that I try to focus on is that I think that two things can be true at once. I think that many of these people who are attending these protests are doing so to protest what they view as overreaching stay-at-home orders. They are also doing so with the full view that President Trump should be elected and that they believe that they can help. And I think that you've seen from the White House and from people who are close to Trump's campaign, they view these protests as a political strategy to divide and conquer and to divide rural areas of states against urban areas of states and even rural Republicans against urban Republicans. So it very much is in line with the president's reelection strategy aimed at getting at the white rural voters that helped turn, say, Michigan on his side in 2016. So I'm sure that there are many people who have attended these protests who did not intend to do so to help President Trump's reelection campaign, but there are many people who absolutely did.
So these protests have been whiter and more in rural areas than in urban areas?
Yes. And not necessarily that these protests have taken place in rural areas, but these protesters are coming from rural areas. In conversations that I had with people who took part in Michigan's protests, there very much was a sense that this is a Detroit issue. In the state of Michigan, Metro Detroit has, I checked a couple of days ago, and I'm sure it may have gotten worse by now, about 13,000 cases of coronavirus. Whereas Traverse City in the state's north, in Traverse County, has about 19 cases of coronavirus. So there is a big rural-urban divide that's taking place right now with coronavirus. And there is a sense, I think, for some that if you are only experiencing the economic deprivations or, you know, you can't go to work, and if you're only experiencing that, but you're not experiencing the coronavirus pandemic itself and the death and destruction that it leaves in its wake, you might have a different perception of this. The issue is that coronavirus is also hitting rural areas as well. And we've seen that in Idaho and South Dakota and other states. And a lot of rural hospitals are largely unprepared and unready for coronavirus. I think that there's this idea that because you're not living in such density that people will be less affected. But density is only one part of the equation. Coronavirus spreads extremely easily and also affects people with a large number of comorbidities. And I think a lot of people think of themselves as not being part of that group that's vulnerable. But people have been infected and died who across all different age platforms. And for instance, I have asthma. Many people have asthma. That's something that is, for coronavirus, a particular vulnerability. And so I think that there is a sense that this pandemic in some way is a blue state problem or an urban problem, when coronavirus itself doesn't care where you live or what your job is or whether or not you're in a rural area or in an urban area. Coronavirus remains incredibly infectious and incredibly dangerous.
So in addition to the protests at the Michigan State House, you had the governor of Michigan being targeted by both these protesters and President Trump.
Again, two things can be true at once. From the protesters or some of the protesters' perspective, that's because, you know, they thought that these shutdown orders seemed confusing. When you think about it, some of the concerns that the protesters had regarding, say, the closing of big box stores makes sense when you think about you know, how social distancing works and how people have been using these stores in the last couple of weeks. And especially when you contemplate how hard Metro Detroit and large swaths of the state of Michigan have been hit by coronavirus. But Governor Whitner is incredibly popular in the state of Michigan and was and still is a potential vice presidential pick for Democratic nominee Joe Biden. So there very much is a sense that aiming attacks at her would help to denigrate her political standing. And you'll notice that a lot of these attacks have, you know, that are especially coming from the White House and from Trump's re-election coalition, they're aimed at Democratic governors. They're not aimed at Republican Larry Hogan, for example, even though Larry Hogan has had his own differences with the Trump administration about attempting to obtain materials to support people with coronavirus. Even when you see Republican Governor Mike DeWine, for example, who has seen some of these protests himself, but that hasn't been coming from the Trump administration. So there is a political calculus that's going on here that is aimed at Democratic governors, even separate from the stay-at-home orders or lockdown procedures.
Compare what we're seeing in the way of these protests to the Tea Party protests we saw earlier in this decade.
When I spoke with the president of FreedomWorks, he told me that these protests have the same DNA as the Tea Party movement. And I think that there are a lot of different ways to interpret that statement. I think that the difference here is that this is taking place under a Republican administration. And you'll notice that many of the protesters seem to separate what they view as, you know, government tyranny, quote unquote, from the Republican government that is encouraging these stay-at-home orders. So it's a confusing dichotomy that's taking place here. And I think, again, what you saw with the Tea Party movement is that there were people in 2009, 2010 that were concerned about bank bailouts and concerned about the deficit. But so many of the groups themselves, you know, the Tea Party Express, for example, now have gone on to become big supporters of the president, who is notably a huge fan of deficit spending and a huge fan of debt. So I think, again, two things can be true at once. The Tea Party movement was simultaneously organic for some, but also a political mechanism for other groups at the time. And I think we're seeing that again now.
Talk about some of the rather extreme groups who are involved in these protests.
Well, I think that one of the challenges with any protest movement is that these protests tend to attract people who may have their own grievances or may have their own viewpoints. And so there's a writer at Mother Jones magazine named Kevin Drum, and he introduced this idea of nut picking, which is essentially when you see a large group of protesters, for example, and you find the guy who's carrying a swastika and a Confederate flag, and you're like, that is who this protest is. That's not necessarily true here. However, a lot of these protests have been very attractive to extremist organizations like the Proud Boys, for example, which is an extremist group whose former leader made a lot of anti-Semitic and racist statements, and they were present at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. Militia members have also attended. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones attended in Austin. Alex Jones is perhaps best known for repeatedly claiming that the Sandy Hook school shootings were a hoax, and he had to settle a defamation lawsuit over that. And a lot of these protests have attracted the same people who might be attracted to an anti-government, anti-vaccine message. You know, you hear people chanting about, you know, fire Fauci, referring to Dr. Anthony Fauci, because they think that he's trying to encourage mass vaccinations because that would be bad in their calculus. So it's challenging because a lot of these protests, you might organize a protest that you think is aimed at, you know, you're very upset about Governor Whitmer closing big box garden stores. And then the people who attend your protest are carrying AK-47s in the state house. And so I think that that's one of the challenges here is to talk about what these protests are intended to say, but also note that these protests have also attracted a host of extremist groups and extremist elements.
So are you suggesting that the extremist groups are simply taking advantage
Yes.
of what they see to gain their own publicity?
Exactly. You know, that's not uncommon. I think that anyone who has ever attended protest for anything will notice that there are groups that show up at protests to make their own political point. And so I think that that in some ways is what's happening here. What's interesting to me is how in conservative media, you know, those people are portrayed as being outliers. Whereas when previous protests took place, for example, Black Lives Matter, let's say, you know, the outliers were portrayed as being the main representative of those groups. And so I think it's worth thinking about how we think about protests in general, that protests do tend to attract people who are both focused on that cause, but also may want to have, you know, air their own grievances. And we have to think about these protest movements fairly, whether or not we agree with the basic political position that they hold.
Jane, we've talked about Stephen Moore. He apparently had a conversation that the New York Times quoted with someone who said that if anyone at these protests got arrested in Michigan, that person would pay the bill for it.
I think that that really does go to show you how much elite support, not necessarily, you know, sometimes when we use the term elite, I think that that has a particular partisan slant. But what I mean by that is these high level conservative groups with significant funding and significant ties to this administration and to Republican politics in general, who are absolutely willing to have some people get arrested in order to further their own political goals. That is particularly telling to me.
I also wanted to ask you, because I've seen their names mentioned so often, the Doar brothers. Tell me who the Doar brothers are and what their influence is here in these protests.
They are a group of brothers who are focused very much on gun rights and support for gun rights causes. And so there are actually four brothers. So they run a network of pro-gun organizations. And what they've done is launch Facebook groups for each state that might want to have these protests. For example, Pennsylvania's against excessive quarantine, New Yorkers against excessive quarantine. And you know, they are not in either of those states. And so what they've done is that they attack conservative organizations from their right and then sell memberships and sell mailing lists of the people who sign up as part of these groups saying, you know, they're saying like, we're the ones standing up for real conservatives or for real Republicans. All you need to do is send this email to announce your support for real conservatism. And so they've actually gotten a lot of condemnation from conservative groups. For example, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life called them established scam artists because they were making fake allegations against conservative and Republican legislatures and then raising money for bills or raising money for efforts that they would claim would, you know, strengthen the Second Amendment or immediately make abortion illegal. And so basically, they've just been supporting their own brand and trying to raise money. The thing about pandemics or any sort of mass problem is how many hucksters and scammers these tend to attract. People who will use individuals' very real sentiments of concern about coronavirus or concern about the stay-at-home orders to make money. And the Doar brothers are decidedly an example of that, that basically they just make these Facebook groups appear to be on the ground in the states where these Facebook groups are discussing, but they're just trying to make money and they're not really doing anything to further the causes that people who join these groups think they are.
And a quick break. More of my conversation with Jane Costin when we come back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Jane Costin. She is a senior political reporter at Vox, where she focuses on conservatism and the American right. What about Republicans in the Senate? To what extent are they supportive of these protests that are going on around the country?
I think that in some respects, you've seen this from Senator Ted Cruz and others. I think that there is a fine line that they are attempting to walk. They know that many of their constituents support these protests. They also are aware that the federal guidance on stay-at-home orders and the safety of their constituents really matters. And for many Senate and congressional Republicans, they're aware that the people who are most likely to be supportive of these protests may also be the people most vulnerable to coronavirus. So, for example, you've seen a lot of efforts to say, you know, these orders, these specific orders, for example, from Governor Whitmer are too extreme. However, you know, we need to listen to the CDC. We need to abide by this guidance, especially since we've seen members of Congress test positive for coronavirus and have to self-isolate themselves. And so I think it's a challenging line to walk where your constituents want something, but your constituents happen to be wrong. And I think that that's what we're seeing from congressional Republicans right now.
Are we seeing an effort on the part of the White House to somehow blame these governors for the coronavirus and the restrictions they're putting on people?
Yes, I think that there is an effort by this administration to attempt to get at both sides of the issue. So to say, for example, as Trump did, that he has total control over what the states do, but then the states have to do whatever they want. And so I think that that is an effort to make it appear as if a continuing outbreak happens in a blue state. Well, that's the governor, you know, that's their problem. That's Democratic politics for you. And, you know, if a red state sees a curtailing of coronavirus, then that's Trump's wondrous achievement. So I think it's an effort in some ways to get at both sides of the same thing and try to, in some ways, win on both sides, that either infection rates go up and it's not Trump's fault, or infection rates go down and it's Trump's amazing achievement.
Is that really an advantageous strategy for Donald Trump?
Well, I don't think so, because I think that how Americans think about public health is the job of the states, according to the Constitution. But for many Americans who have been watching these press conferences each day coming from the CDC and paying attention to Dr. Fauci, and moreover, widely accepting of social distancing and stay-at-home orders. You know, the majority of Americans don't support these protests, and the majority of Americans think that Trump has not done enough to fight coronavirus. So it's very complicated, especially when Trump keeps saying that he has total control and he's in charge, to then say, oh, I'm actually not in charge. These governors, it's their fault. And so I think that it may seem advantageous, but one of the challenges that this administration faces is that this isn't like the Russia investigation or the impeachment trials. The coronavirus is a pandemic, and pandemics are beyond, you know, individual politics or even individual people. Pandemics are an ancient concern of every civilization, you know, going back thousands of years. You know, there's the smallpox pandemic of Emperor Justinian, for example, and more famously, the Black Death. You know, we've seen H1N1 even more recently, the Spanish flu of 1918. We have seen pandemics before, and each of those pandemics has been beyond even the politics of the time. And so I think that attempting to use coronavirus as a political cudgel to get back at Democratic governors or get back even at insufficiently supportive Republicans is a big risk, in my view. You know, obviously, I don't know the future and I don't know what this will result in, but it does seem to me that attempting to make this pandemic into an issue against which Trump can run is asking a lot of both our public health resources and a lot of Americans who he is simultaneously asking him to trust him explicitly, but also it's the governor's fault.
So I think the figure is like 70% of Americans believe that these stay-in-place orders should continue and the self-distancing ought to continue. But there you have the governor of Georgia, who has opened a number of different kinds of businesses. And you had Dr. Birx in an really awkward position the other day on the White House stage saying, well, you know, speaking about massaging or barbering, well, if you can figure out how to do that and keep social distance, well, people are creative. They'll be able to do that. So if Georgia sees a rise in the outbreak of coronavirus in its state, what's that going to mean to the governor of Georgia?
Well, it'll be on the clear because, again, Georgia is making a extremely, and I won't even call it calculated because it doesn't seem to be, a big risk, which is to hope that the curve has been flattened enough in the state of Georgia to allow these, to allow Georgia to ignore the phase one guidance of the White House with regard to what businesses can open. And I think I understand that his imperative is thinking about the number of, for example, in Atlanta, I think there was a graph that was going around yesterday of the number of cosmetologists or the number of people who are working in those industries who have lost weeks of employment and weeks of paychecks. I think that that is an understandable impetus. However, if the number of cases skyrockets and they have to return to a shutdown status, I think that that's going to be a big black mark on the governor's record. You know, he is betting that that cases won't expand, or I think in some ways he is betting that the cases that's due, that may skyrocket will happen in specific communities where it'll be easier to say, like, okay, that's Atlanta's problem, but this area of Georgia is okay. This very much to me seems, again, like a rural versus urban issue that is very much hoping that this outbreak does not impact the people who might be most supportive of the governor. And I know that that sounds in many ways deeply concerning, which I find it to be. But I think that from a political perspective, there very much is an understanding that, you know, if you can say we opened up the economy, quote unquote, which isn't really a real thing, you know, we opened up the economy and, you know, sure, these deaths increased, but we were ready to handle it and our hospitals were ready. There very much is a political calculus going on here. And I'm not quite sure what the ultimate result will be.
We have seen African Americans hit disproportionately by this virus. Are African Americans among the protesters who are out there around the country?
I haven't seen a protest with a large number of African American attendees. Morning Consult put out some numbers earlier today saying that 70% of Black Americans polled supported the current measures aimed at eliminating or curtailing the coronavirus pandemic, while simultaneously being, one, most vulnerable to coronavirus, and two, most vulnerable to the economic impact of coronavirus. African Americans are more likely to be working at businesses that are likely closed, or they're more likely also to be working in essential industries. And let's keep in mind that essential industries aren't just hospitals, but they are also grocery stores. And the workers who are still at local grocery stores or carrying out the trash at a hospital, those people are just as vulnerable in some cases as the people who are working above them in hospitals themselves. And so I think that what you've seen, especially as this community remains incredibly vulnerable, is that they, you know, African Americans, based on the polling, recognize that they are more vulnerable to this, and they recognize the economic impact this is having firsthand, but they also are aware of what's needed to stop the spread of infection.
Do you see these protests continuing to grow, or considering the small numbers of people who have come out, with some exceptions, do you see them sort of petering out?
I think that there is a good chance that these peter out, especially because I think, one, in many of the states that these have taken place in, you are starting to see the governors themselves start to talk more about, okay, this is what a reopening procedure might look like. I also think that there's been enough information about kind of the bases of these protests and how unreflective they are of national opinion. It's worth noting, though, that these protests, I think, aren't just about trying to change that public opinion, but also trying to make these shutdowns a partisan issue. that in order to support President Trump, you have to oppose these shutdown measures that are ironically being supported by the federal government. So I think it's worth thinking about that. And we're starting to see some polling that this is becoming more of a partisan issue, but not nearly as much as I think some people may expect. I obviously don't know. I think that if there's anything we've learned during this pandemic is that there's a lot of information we don't have yet about how people will respond. And I would be the first to say that on a lot of this, I don't know. But I would say that I would guess that these protests, particularly as states start announcing what they're interested in doing or trying to make it more clear why they're doing what they're doing, I would guess that these may peter out.
Jane, you said earlier in our discussion, you are asthmatic. How are you taking care of yourself?
So we've been practicing social distancing pretty stringently. I've been working from home for the last month or month and a half or so. I'm also a runner, which has been an interesting challenge. I've spent a lot of time running in bike lanes, and I apologize to all the cyclists out there. But, I live in Washington, D.C., where that's possible to take a walk without encountering other people or to do so in a safe manner. You see how much our lived environments impact how we're able to function during this pandemic. If walking to the grocery store or just taking a walk in general means you need to go next to a highway, it's not as much of an option. I think that, I've been able to take really good care of myself, but it does make me concerned about others who are in the same boat as I am with asthma or high blood pressure or a pre-existing condition that might make them more vulnerable, but also without the boons of living somewhere where that kind of social distancing while allowing yourselves to get outside and enjoy fresh air aren't possible.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close?
I would just say that I think one of the challenges we have in the media is whether or not to amplify a message or how to talk about a protest movement or talk about something that doesn't in some ways help to either boost it or knock it down or impact it, which is incredibly difficult. And we've seen this across the board with how we think about politics. But I think that these protests are useful to discuss. One, to talk about how each of these states has dealt with coronavirus differently, but also to talk about the political imperatives that coronavirus is now existing on top of. I regret that we could not take a break from politics in order to handle this pandemic. We couldn't all say, for right now, we're not Democrats, Republicans, or Libertarians. We're all just Americans trying to counter coronavirus. That wasn't even possible during the Second World War, contrary to what some people think. But it's worth thinking about how coronavirus has intersected with our existing political imperatives and made the fight against coronavirus more difficult.
Jane, thank you so much. It was good to talk with you.
It was great to talk with you.
That's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you want me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, theartpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Lansford of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Mike Kitt. Thanks for listening, all. Please do take care of yourself. Stay safe. I'm Diane Reed.